Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence.
All right, so funny story here. Last week, Peyton, fabulous job. He did a fabulous job with 1 Samuel 4. If you didn't hear it, you need to go back and listen to it, because today's message will make a whole lot more sense if you've heard his as well, okay? Now, don't listen to it now. You could, but I'd appreciate it, you know. Anyway, go back and listen to it. Here's the funny story. The funny story is not his preaching. He did great. The funny story is, several weeks ago, I'm a planner for sermons. If y'all don't know that, I've got a whole spreadsheet going back 5 years with everything I've preached. It's color coordinated if I'm in a series and all of that. I know, OCD, nerd, here we go. So I had planned out that, you know, where I was going to be so Pastor Logan could preach 1 Samuel 3. And then Peyton was like, hey, where will that put y'all when I preach? And I said, well, Logan will have just finished 1 Samuel 3. Totally my fault. I did not check with him and say, hey, exactly what are you preaching on? Until Thursday at the beach. I said, hey, send me what you're preaching on, and I'll make sure the verses are all in there and in the slides and all, da 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 da, right? And he said, hey, preaching on 1 Samuel 4. And I was like, oh. Because see, before I left on vacation, I wrote an entire sermon on 1 Samuel 4 that nobody will ever get to hear, right? But as I sat there last Sunday, I was like, he hit every point that I was going to say. So I was like, look at there. The Lord worked it out anyway. So today, we're in 1 Samuel 5. And here's how this story lays out. 1 Samuel 4, 5, and 6 are like a trilogy, okay? It means all three chapters work together to tell a comprehensive story. I labeled it the Philistines and the Ark because both are involved. Last week, the story focused on the Israelites. Today, the story is going to focus on the Ark, literally in the land of the Philistines. Now, before we jump into the story, we need to talk about two things really quickly that are kind of background issues. Let's again talk about the Philistines just as a recap so we're all on the same page as to who they are. And then we're going to talk about another key player in the story named Dagon. Okay? And so here are the Philistines. The Philistines are not native to Canaan or to the greater ancient Near East is what it's called. They're not a tribe that wandered in. They're not nomadic. They were a seafaring people that just showed up, literally about the time of the Iron Age. Most scholars today believe they were from the Greek speaking world and were an island people from like Crete or Cyprus or somewhere in that area that had Greek roots and that were sailors. And so they sailed, and some kind of landed in like toward Egypt. But the majority, at least for our concern, landed on the coast of modern day Israel. In fact, one of the cities that they claim as their own is Gaza, as in the Gaza Strip, right? And so they land in that area, and they quickly carve out a stronghold of five cities called a pentapolis. And that's how their leadership structure is made. They don't really have a king, but they have leaders. We'll meet them in, we won't know their names, but we'll meet them in the story. And so this pentapolis of cities is made up of five. Pentapolis, five cities, right? That's how that works. All right, and so here are the five cities. Gaza, that's one. Ashkelon is another, Ashdod, Gath, and Ekron. Now, you may remember Gath because there was a really tall guy who we'll meet later in Samuel who's also from Gath. Anybody know his name? You should know his name. Really tall. Goliath. Yes, there we go. Right? Goliath, 1 year. I think I told this story, but it bears repeating, and I'll probably tell it again when we get to the David and Goliath story. But one year for VBS, we had this really creative lady when we were up in Athens, and she literally made a 9-foot-tall Goliath out of, I don't know how many pieces of, like, that roll paper she used. But, I mean, if you in your mind, what do you think Goliath looked like? But he was on the wall in the gym at church, and little preschoolers would come by and play David and throw balls of paper, and it would be like hitting him in the knee. And then you'd get the older kids who'd really, you know, you could tell the kids who played baseball because they're like crow hopping, and you know, hit him right in the head, and everybody cheer. It was great. It was great. Anyway, he's from Gath along with his family. But today, we're going to talk about kind of all of them collectively. Now, the other thing we need to talk about is Dagon. Dagon is their chief god. They adopted him when they got there because he is a regional deity that other Semitic or Syrian people worshipped at that time. And so they adopted him. They come in like barnstormers, and they literally carve out a swath of land along the coast. And in Samuel, they are the arch enemies of Israel. All right. So last week we saw that there was a big battle. Israel lost 43,000 soldiers. That's a lot, right? And what happens is the Philistines, not only do they defeat Israel, but they capture the Ark of the Covenant, which you'll remember is God, represents God's presence on earth. And that's where we pick up the story today. We will read the first 5 verses. Here we go. When the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. That's about 20 to 30 miles away toward the coast. All right, verse 2. Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face down, downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. Verse 4. But when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. Verse 5. Now here's a little just editorial note. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon and Ashdod to this day. Right? So many years later, there's still some cultural impact of this event here. All right, so let's go back and let's talk about the story. All right, so verse 1, pretty easy to understand, right? Philistines win. They're at Ebenezer. They take the Ark of the Covenant back to Ashdod because that's where the temple of Dagon is. And so notice what it says in verse number 2. Ren, throw verse number 2 back up for us. Notice the language. I want you to listen to the language very carefully. Then the Philistines took the Ark of the Covenant and brought it into the house of the temple. Now look at the preposition. Is that right? And they set it up where? Beside Dagon. That's going to be key. All right. Here's the idea. Now, why do they do this? Let's answer this question. A lot of this story is very culturally conditioned. Okay. So here's the situation. They have the temple of Dagon, and Dagon is a statue. Wood, stone, gold, silver, something like that. And he's like up on a pedestal, right? Kind of a, you know, they got a pedestal stand and the statue is up on that. Now notice, where do they take the Ark of the Covenant? They put it beside Dagon, all right? Now why do they do that? They do that for 2 reasons. So in their minds, if you remember, Peyton talked about this last week, that the Philistines had heard about the God of Israel. They had heard about what the God of Israel did to the Egyptians, but they had just witnessed a great rout on their part of Israel such that they captured this treasured religious object. So in the Philistines' worldview, that meant that their little g-god, Dagon, was greater than that of Israel. So what do you do when you win the spoils of victory? You take them and put them back in your house of worship. This was a common practice. Why? Because clearly your God is better than their God. Secondly, if there is any, now this is their worldview, okay, not Israel's worldview, the Philistines, because if there is any vestige of power, quote unquote, left in the ark, then because Dagon is more powerful than Israel's God, he will subsume or absorb their power and be even greater. You see how that works? Sounds crazy to us, but that's their worldview. Okay, that's why they put the ark beside Dagon. Now, go to verse 3. Again, listen to the language. What does it say? And when the people of Ashdod rose early next morning, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground. What's the word? Huh. Before. What does that mean? In front of. Tanner, come up here for a minute. Come right here. Come on. Stand right here. All right. Tanner is going to represent the position of the ark. Okay? Now, if I'm the Dagon statue, right? And he's beside me, before doesn't mean the statue falls this way, right? Because I'd still be beside. It also doesn't mean I go backwards, because that would be behind. So it either means that the statue fell this way, or that the statue jumped off the pedestal and fell this way. Okay? Right? Good job. You get a gold star. And no high five. All right. So do you see? So the ark is beside, but somehow Dagon ends up in front of, bowing down before the Ark of the Covenant. Pretty interesting, right? Now, what happens on day two? That's one day. So what are the priests have to what? Pick him back up and put him back on the pedestal. Right? Now, the second day, the same thing happens again in verse 4. The same thing happens again. It says, he was beside, they set him back up. So, the rest of that day, the ark is beside, they're beside each other. But the second morning, where's Dagon again? In front of, before the ark, in front of the ark. Except this time, what has happened? His head is cut off. And his hands are cut off. Only his torso, like from here down, is left. Now that sounds really odd to us. But let me tell you, God is speaking to the Philistines in words that they, or in actions in this case, that they will clearly understand. It may not make sense to me and you. That's why we're going to talk about it. But the Philistines would immediately have gotten the picture. Well, what picture was God trying to show them? Number one, this is in your outline. Number one, these events are not anomalies. Right, let's be real. If it happens one day, maybe the wind blew. Maybe there was an earthquake. I find it highly interesting. Right, because listen, I'm going to tell you. We're going to go into the weeds just for a moment, okay? Just for a moment. Follow with me. Remember, who is writing the Samuel stories? I'll give you two choices. An Israelite or a Philistine? An Israelite. So let me ask you this. How did the Israelites get the story about what happened in the Philistine temple? How do you get that story? It's real easy. Somebody's got to tell you. Who is that person? A Philistine. They have to get this story somehow, right? Notice what the Philistines don't tell them. Hey man, there was a great earthquake last night. Did y'all feel it? And we came in, and man, the statue of Dagon, somehow he fell right in front of y'all's ark. Do they say that? No. Do they say, man, there was a mighty wind that came off the ocean, and somehow it didn't push him backwards, but it pushed him forward, and he fell down right in front of you? They don't say, you know, there was some kid in there playing around. We told them not to be in there, and they hit it and pushed it off. Do they say that? Nope. So what does the story give us the impression that happens? That everything, it's a normal night, and Buddy the priest walks in and is, bam! Somehow this statue is on the ground in front of the ark. 2 days in a row. And nobody felt any tremors. There was no great winds. There was no great storms. It was a normal night. And 2 days in a row, bam, there it is. What is that telling them? This is not an accident. Now here's the second thing. It is a symbol of subservience. Whenever someone bows down in front of another, that is a cultural symbol of servitude, right? In the New Testament, when Paul writes in Philippians chapter 2 that one day every knee will bow and every tongue will confess, both those in heaven and off and under the earth, that Jesus Christ is Lord, what is Paul saying? One day everybody will show servitude and humility before Jesus. This is what's going on here as well. So immediately the Philistines would have known, hey, this didn't happen by chance. It's 2 days in a row. Number two, our God is serving their God in humility and servitude. Now here's the third thing, and this is a little grisly. Sorry about that. This is the way it is. In the ancient world, one of the ways that they determined how many people, if you were the victors of a battle, one of the ways that they determined how many people died of your enemy in battle is they would cut off the heads of people or they would cut off their hands. That's how they counted. That's how a victorious army counted the dead. Right? That's just the way it was. Okay? So what do the Philistines immediately understand? Well, we might have won the battle over there, but here in our own home, in Dagon's own temple, in his house, there's something going on that we can't see, that's in a realm beyond our ability, where our God has been utterly defeated in his own hometown, in his own bedroom. He has been annihilated. This entire first four verses is a victory scene on a battle. And the Philistines quickly understand, we only thought we won. Now, not only is there this religious victory going on inside the house of Dagon that shows that Dagon is subservient, that he's not really who they say he is, that he's been utterly defeated. But outside the temple, the Philistines at large are experiencing physical and mental punishment, judgment as well. So God has judged their religious system, and now he's judging them physically and mentally. Let's read the rest of the chapter, starting in verse number 6. We'll go all the way to the end. The hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, "The ark of God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon, our God." So they sent and gathered together the lords of the Philistines, that's the people in charge of the five cities, and said, "What shall we do with the ark of God of Israel?" They answered, "Let the ark of God of Israel be brought around to Gath." So they brought the ark of God of Israel there, verse 9. But after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against that city, or against the city, causing a very great panic. And he afflicted the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. Verse 10. So they sent the ark of God to Ekron. But as soon as the ark of God came to Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, "They have brought around to us the ark of God of Israel to kill us and our people." Verse 11. They sent, therefore, and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Send away the ark, the God of Israel, and let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people." For there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. All right, last verse. the men who did not die were struck with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. All right, so we have this religious judgment going on in the house of Dagon, but then outside amongst the larger civilization, what do we have going on? Judgment as well, that is both physical and mental. Here's what I mean. Now, I want you to notice some of the words. I've got them in your outline. Some of the words that the authors use to describe what is going on in the lives of the people. All right, first, let's talk about tumors. Now, when you and I think of tumors, what do we think of? Cancer. That's probably not what's going on here. The word tumor here is closely aligned with boils or like festering pustules. Very nice word, right? Pustules, right? Most scholars believe it would be something like the Black Plague, you know, where you got these growths, like it's not cancer, but it's and ultimately you die from it, right? And so that's what it means by tumors, right? Not cancerous, but like boils and things you can see on your skin that puff up, pustules, right? All right, so not only do they get those, that's what that word means, but the text tells us they were terrified. Listen to this. I thought this was fascinating. The word terrified here is the same word that is associated with a desert. It literally means uninhabitable or desolate place. In other words, they were desolate in themselves. Like it was like a wilderness in their own life. Not only does he use tumor, they have tumors, terrified. He uses afflicted, which is the word for hit or strike. And then the text tells us two things. That there was a very great panic and a deathly panic. That word panic there means a confused mental state. So in Gath, they have a very great panic. I mean, everybody is like going crazy, like literally. Like, oh. But in Ekron, what happens? The panic turns to killing each other. Right? That's why in the last verse, in verse 12, it says, you know, those who did not die were struck with the tumors because they were in such a crazed frenzy that obviously people in the city started killing each other. Right? This confused mental state caused death, literally, and destruction. And so it, on one hand, if you follow the trajectory, things progressively get worse, right? Ashdod just has the tumors. Gath has the tumors and a great panic. And Ekron has the tumors and a deathly panic, right? And so things are progressively getting... No wonder the people of Ekron are like, you're bringing it here to kill us all. I mean, they've seen how this thing plays out. They know what's... The word has spread. Right? So, the question then is, what... Oh, one other thing. Oh, this is the best part. This is the best part. One of the great things about this passage that the author does magnificently is this phrase, the hand of the Lord. Right? It was in verse number 6, the beginning. The hand of the Lord was heavy. The word heavy there literally means weight, like large weight. And so the idea is that the Lord's hand was pressing down on these people. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us two things really quickly. Number one, it does not, let me phrase that better. It means we cannot sugarcoat this passage, but we have to deal with the fact that God was directly involved in bringing about punishment on the Philistines. Right? But the author's very clear. The hand of the Lord was heavy. God was doing all of this. So it doesn't let us go, well, you know. No, it's boom, there it is. But here's the other really cool thing. Is the irony in the passage. What happened to Dagon on day 2? What happened? The statue? He fell down and his head and hands were cut off. So what does that mean? He's powerless, but what do we have here? The hand of the Lord, free. His hand ain't cut off. He's still got all his fingers and toes. And what are his hands able to do? Anything they want. And so there's this dichotomy of, oh, Philistines, you thought you guys were powerful and you thought Dagon was in control. Let me show you what's really going on, right? And so there's irony built in the passage. So here's the big question. What is this passage trying to tell us? All right. Now, in order to answer that question, we got to remind ourselves of what we learned last week in chapter 4. What did we learn last week in chapter 4? The Ark of the Covenant is what Peyton said. The Ark of the Covenant is not a magic box. Or as he said it, God is not a trinket. He is not a special amulet that we can wear around our chest. Or that Israel can parade in a battle and think, oh, well, now that we've got this magic item, God will do our bidding. And so we conclude with that main idea is that the sons of the covenant, Israel, when they do not follow after the Lord, they will be held accountable first. Right? That's the main point of chapter 4. When the sons of the covenant, when the people of the covenant disobey the covenant, they will be held accountable. God will judge them. Okay? Now, so what does that tell us about chapter 5? It tells us two things. God ain't real good English here. God ain't subservient to nobody and no thing. God is not subservient to anyone. And number two, main point B, God judges and punishes all who violate the covenant. You say, well, how did the Philistines violate the covenant? Number one, what did they do? They took the ark and put it what? Beside Dagon. And then after he fell off the pedestal the first day, they didn't go, huh, maybe we should do something about that. What'd they do? Stuck him right back up there. And after day two, and his head and his hands cut off, did they go, maybe we ought to think about this? No. They stuck him right back up there. And after it caused, and after all these tumors went from place to place to place, did they go, maybe we should figure out what this God of the ark wants? What do? We'll talk about this next week. They send it back. They at no point ever go, maybe we've done something wrong and we should try to figure out what it is. They never do that. They're just like, get the thing out of here. Right? And so what we see in these two chapters is a message that includes both sides of the same coin. God judges his own people when they don't violate the covenant, and God judges everyone when they violate the covenant, because God will not be mocked or will not be superseded by anything or anyone. So when we ask the question, how does this apply to my life today? How does this story impact me? I think there's two clear ways it does that. Number one is a reminder. Number two is a warning. Here's the reminder. Do not be lulled into sleep in your thinking that God does not care about his name, his honor, or his word. Just, this is a really long point, just because he doesn't act in a way you think he should to someone you think he should, in a way you think he should, when he should do it, in your mind. Does that make sense? Like we've all, listen. We've all been there. And we've been like, man, God really needs to do something about that. And then nothing happens. And in some cases, the person prospers. And you're like, Lord, why? What does this story teach us? It's not up to us, the timing and the place and the season, when God does what only he can do. It's not your responsibility and my responsibility to judge the Philistines in our lives. Now, that doesn't mean, like our current culture says, you know, nobody can judge me, right? Which they mean is don't tell me what to do. I'm not saying that. That's not what I'm meaning here. I mean, God is responsible for holding accountable peoples and groups who do not honor and serve him. And one day he will do that. It may not be when you want it done, and it may not be when I want it done. Because there's times in my lives where I'm like, God, get them today, now. Don't wait another second. They deserve it. Right? And then, you know, in a few minutes, you're like, yeah, I probably deserved it too. All right, so that's the warning. Don't be lulled into sleep to thinking that because God doesn't work when you want him to, in a way you want him to, how you want him to, that God doesn't care about his honor, his name, or his word. Now, that's the reminder. All right, that's easy. Here's the warning, and this one's tough because it takes day-to-day work in our own lives. We must always be cognizant that we are not trying to make big G God, God of the universe, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, God the Father, that we are not trying to make him subservient to someone or something in our own lives. Right? You say, what does that look like? Two examples today. Sometimes I do this, sometimes I don't. I got two examples today. Now, I would imagine that most of you would not say literally the first one, but you'll get the point. God, you're just going to have to wait. Right? Come on. God, you're just going to have to wait. Hey, I got a lot to do today. Do you not see my list of things? I love you, Lord, but you're going to have to wait. What have you just done? Whatever this is, whoop, above God. You've put God beside your list of whatever it is. Hey, well, I know you told me to do blank, but God, you're just going to have to wait. It's not the right time in my life. Hey, I know I should do this, but hey, God, you're just going to have to wait. Whenever we're in the God, you're going to have to wait mode, we have just done what the Philistines did. And we have tried to make God subservient to whatever that thing is, or list of things, or time, or season, or whatever it is in our own life, right? That's example number one of how we can make God subservient to stuff. Here's number two. It's in your outline. You can read along. When we allow our passion for something or someone to overtake our passion for the Lord. For example, if our hobbies or our things we're interested in overtake our desire to know and serve the Lord, then we are woefully off track. Tell a quick story. We had a guy at a previous church years ago, I mean decades ago, that when I you know, did like I do here, stand out, shake, you know, stand at the back, shake hands as you go out, you know, and you know, I pretty much say about the same thing I say, you know, creature of habit, you know. Hey man, hope you have a great week. You know, God bless you, da-da. You know, hey, see you next week. And his line every week would be, man, preacher, we're going to be here if the ox don't get in the ditch. Which meant if something don't come up major. Right? Now, let me remind you, he did not have an ox at all. That was, and that community was a, have everybody, except for one retired teacher, did something with farming. If you didn't farm, you sold insurance to farmers. Just the way it worked. Okay? That was that guy. And I got it. My granddad farmed. You know, sometimes if it rains real hard or it's about to rain, you gotta get crops in the ground. Like you gotta go today. Right? And if there's no rain and all your first crops have come up and, you know, died, you gotta get it in the ground today. Or if it's about to rain and it's the end of the season, you got to pick stuff right then. Right? You got to go. I get it. Here's what I realized, though. That ox started getting in that ditch a lot.
And it always seemed to get in the ditch on
Saturday night and Sunday morning. It never got in the ditch on Tuesday. Shocking how that worked. Or Thursday. Or Friday afternoon. It was always late Saturday night into Sunday morning. And here's how I know. Facebook. Facebook don't lie. I'm telling you. When we get out of church and the ox obviously got in the ditch, and I see at 1 o'clock that your wife posted an hour earlier that you was at the fair in Perry, did the ox really get in the ditch? No, you just wanted to go to the fair. That's right. Okay, I got it. We go to the fair too. Love the fair. But when that happens over and over and over and over and over, is the ox really getting in the ditch? Or are we just finding excuses not to worship with people together with the Lord? Right? And you may say, well, preacher, there's other stuff. Yeah. Hey, I get it. Sunday morning worship ain't the end all be all. There was many a Sunday as a 12, 13-year-old that I was there every time the door was open, lost as a ball, and I was, didn't care, wanted to know who was playing football that afternoon, was worried about what was going to eat for dinner, and that my mom and dad were going to make me go to that stinking children's choir that I hated. Right? I was there, but my passions were not there. So being at church ain't the end all be all. I'm just using an example. Is there are many a time our ox gets in the ditch, and it ain't really an ox. It's just really, we want to do what we want to do. And we want to do what we want to do more than we want to do what the Lord wants us to do. And whenever we get to that place, we're being more like the Philistines. And more like the Philistines. And more like the Philistines. And as we'll see, that doesn't end well. And I'm confident that's not where you want to end as well. So what do we got to do? We got to let the Lord have primacy and priority, not just in one area of our life, but in every area of our life, so that we are more passionate for Him than we are for anything else in our life.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.